the sexually transmitted diseases. These diseases account for millions of infections yearly. They cost billions of healthcare dollars. They're most prevalent during the adolescent, young years, young 20s, young adults. In fact, some estimates say two-thirds of them occur before age 25. They're often kind of a sexist type disease in the sense that females suffer more than males do in most of these. And there are complications that do affect the infant or the neonate. We'll talk about some of those complications. First of all, there was a couple years ago an article in the local newspaper says STD rise is a big Utah worry. Okay, in 2006, Davis County reported a 16.8% increase from the previous year in reported cases of the sexually transmitted disease. Statewide, the increase was not much less than 12.4%, or 572 more cases than the year before. Gonorrhea rates in Utah increased a staggering 195% between 2000 and 2005, jumped from 231 to 896 cases. The jump is nearly five times the increase found in other western states and comes at a time when the national rate is on the decline. Okay, what's wrong with Utah? Health officials attribute the growing caseloads to a number of factors, including people's lack of awareness about sexually transmitted diseases, as well as better and more frequent testing and better reporting methods. So we do have better methods of identifying. Large part of the problem is that many people don't know they're infected, which is a possibility. Chlamydia in particular is asymptomatic, so it is easy to unknowingly spread the disease to sexual partners. State law requires that chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV be reported to either local health departments or the state health department. Okay, so just showing you that it's still definitely a problem out there, and Utah, still a problem. Okay, let's go through the reproductive organs just very briefly. In the male, in the testes, there's spermatogenesis, so that's where the sperm form and testosterone forms. The sperm move up to the epididymis, where there's more sperm, spermatogenesis, and they mature in the epididymis. Then they travel along the vas deferens over here. The opening expands of the vas deferens into the seminal vesicle, and that's where nutrients like fructose and other nutrients are added for the sperm. The ejaculatory duct is in here, pass through there. The prostate gland kind of surrounds this area. There's more of an alkyl nutrient substance at that point. And then it travels down the urethra. So, disease, infection, inflammation of the urethra, the epididymis, the prostate, any of those areas in there for the male. Okay, in the female, the ovary is where the eggs are produced. They then leave the ovary and go into the oviduct, also known as the fallopian tubes. And that's usually where fertilization occurs in the oviduct, and then they travel down to the uterus. The inside lining of the uterus is the endometrium. Myometrium is the muscular part of the uterus, and that's where implantation occurs, and of course that's where the fetus grows. The outer part of the uterus is the cervix. That can be infected, cervicitis, we'll talk about that. Then it leads down into the birth canal, which is the vagina, vaginitis, and get infections there to the outside opening. Okay, so those are kind of the areas that we're talking about as far as sexually transmitted diseases and what parts of the anatomy become infected. Okay, let's go on to general symptoms. They can range anywhere from asymptomatic. Like I said, people can be infected and not know they're infected, but still pass it on. There might be localized lesions on the external genitalia, lymphadenopathy, swollen lymph glands. In the male, most commonly we see urethritis, prostatitis, epididymitis, inflammation of those three. That doesn't mean there can't be others, but those are the most common types of symptoms and where they occur. In females, urethritis, cervicitis, with salpingitis. Of the salping. That's the fallopian tubes. This is inflammation of the fallopian tubes. PID stands for pelvic inflammatory disease. That's kind of a lower abdominal condition, and it's more systemic. So the symptoms would be like fever, chills, malaise, lower abdominal pain. That's kind of a more severe generalized. We'll talk a little bit about more, about PID, because that can lead to sterility in a female, and then vaginitis. Okay. Classical STDs. These are the ones that have been around for centuries worldwide, not just U.S. but worldwide, and they're still here. Chancroid, gonorrhea, and syphilis. Those three are considered the classical. But there's 20 or more other disorders, other pathogens that cause other types of STDs. So we're going to talk about these three as well as many of the others. Okay, let's take a look at the normal flora of the genital tract. Now, this is primarily female. Males, mostly it's sterile, except for the very outside opening of the urethra, as we've already talked about in urine cultures. So for females, the vaginal tract is sterile at birth, but it's usually colonized within about 6 hours. It doesn't take long to start colonizing. And then after puberty, when the hormones, the estrogen and that, starts flowing, we get a deposition of glycogen in the area, and then the normal flora can change a little bit. So we have prepubertal, and then we have puberty and through menopause, and then post-menopause, with the absence of the estrogen, it changes a little bit more. But generally, this is a percentage. So lactobacilli. These are gram-positive rods. We're going to talk about lactobacilli this week. Coagulative staph, Prevotella, Peptostrep, those are both anaerobes. So, and as well as down here, Bacteroides, Violanella, Fusel, those are anaerobes. So we can have anaerobic infections in there. Regular strep, ureaplasma, ureolyticum, that's in the same family as mycoplasma. What does mycoplasma cause? Mycoplasma.
Walking pneumonia.
Primary atypical pneumonia. What is unique about mycoplasma that is different from other bacteria?
Cell wall.
Lack of cell wall, right. So ureaplasma kind of fits in that category. Enterococci, Gardnerella. Okay, this is another new one that we're going to introduce this week. So let me just highlight this. About half of the population, half of the female population, has Gardnerella as normal flora. But it can also be a pathogen. So this becomes problematic then. If we culture Gardnerella, is it normal flora or is it a pathogen? So we're going to talk a little bit more about this and how we can better determine if it is a pathogen or not. Okay, so a lot of organisms can be in there. And again, this probably refers to a female in the menopausal age group where the estrogens are helping some of the organisms to grow. Okay, pathogens in the female genital tract. Neisseria gonorrhea, Treponema pallidum, Strep A galactae, we've already talked about that. May not be pathogenic to the female, but it can be certainly pathogenic to the infant. So you remember all that. Staph aureus, here's Gardnerella, again. Chlamydia, even Listeria. We've talked about Listeria. Again, it's probably not pathogenic to the female, but it can be transmitted to the fetus or the infant. Mycoplasma, ureaplasma, viruses, herpes, cytomegalovirus, and some parasites, Pithrus pubis, Trichomonas. So we're going to talk about all of these, and well, not all of them, but the newer ones that we haven't talked about. Okay, what do we do for specimen collection? What type of specimens do we get? We can get a cervical specimen, and again, that applies to the female, obviously. We can use a swab, so it's okay to use a swab inserted about 2 centimeters into the cervix, but it needs to be placed in transport media immediately and transported to the lab. Or we can use a cytobrush. So a cytobrush is just a little tiny brush instead of swab, so it's got brush ends on it. And the reason we use a cytobrush is it'll be twisted and turned, and it will grab some of the cells that are there. And we need that particularly for chlamydia, because chlamydia are intracellular pathogens, and they grow in cells. We can't grow them on routine media. We have to do cell cultures, as we've already talked about, for chlamydia. So that's why the cytobrush is useful, is to collect the cells as well. We can get vaginal specimens, vesicle fluid or scrapings. So we'll see that some of these diseases have actual vesicles. Ulcers, sores, we can get fluid from that. We can do a biopsy. We can aspirate fluid from lymph nodes. So there's a variety of types of samples that we can get in the lab to analyze for these sexually transmitted diseases. Okay, what else can we do in the lab for diagnosis then, once we've got the specimen? Well, the Gram stain. Gram stain is pertinent to just about everything. And sometimes we can get a preliminary diagnosis just from the Gram stain. Gemsa stain is more for parasites. Wet mounts, where we just put some of the fluid itself on a slide that's got a little concave area in it, cover slip it, and then we can see the organisms moving around, so we don't really stain them, but we see them moving around. Clue cells, we're going to talk about clue cells a little bit later. These are squamous epithelial cells from the vaginal tract, and they have the edges particularly are coated with bacteria. And sometimes that's a clue as to the type of disease we're dealing with. So we'll talk more about clue cells. We can do serology, which is antigen antibody studies, particularly fluorescent antibody testing. That's helpful for treponema. What type of organism is treponema? Is it bacteria? Virus? Parasite?
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. What?
Things are parasites.
Treponema?
That's
changing. That sounds like spirochete. It's a bacteria. Spirochete. But we can't culture it on routine media. So we can do fluorescent antibody staining. We'll take a look at that. Cultures on many of these we can culture. And the newer entry into microbiology diagnosis is the nucleic acid amplification tests, often abbreviated as the NATS, nucleic acid. And so again, it will be you people, the four-year degree people, clinical laboratory scientists, that will be doing these nucleic acid studies, which is very exciting. Okay, so a lot of different things we can do in the lab. Okay, let's begin talking about our diseases. We'll begin with chancroid, which is also known as soft chancre. The organism that causes chancroid, and this one is predominant worldwide. Okay, we don't see so much of it here, as this indicates maybe 5,000 cases per year in the U.S. You don't have to memorize these numbers. I'm going to give you statistics. That's just for your orientation. But you don't have to memorize those numbers. So we do see it here, but it's more predominant worldwide. Worldwide cause of genital ulcers, as it says here. Haemophilus, okay, you know about Haemophilus. Tell me something that you know about Haemophilus. Excuse me? It's fastidious, right. What media do we need to grow? Chocolate in particular. Okay. What's special about chocolate? How do we get X and D factors in
there? Lysing the red blood cells.
Lysing the red blood cells. Pouring the blood into the auger while it's still hot. Lyses the blood and we get X and D factors. Okay, so this one does require at least X factor for growth. This one, unlike many of the others, has a predominant 10-to-1 ratio male to female. Most of the others are, the females are mostly deficient. That doesn't mean males can't get them. They certainly can. Transmission is just a little bit easier from male to female in most of these cases. But this one seems to affect males more predominantly. Symptoms range from a tender papule to a pustule to an ulcer. We call it a soft ulcer. That's what gets the name soft chancre. So chancre actually means ulcer. Enlarged lymph nodes, primarily in the groin area. And the lymph nodes can drain, or the external genitalia can drain. So here's chancroid. You can just barely see on this one the ulcer. And oftentimes, these can mimic, look like other types of sexually transmitted diseases. So initially, it may not always be easy to tell what the disorder is. These are more clear-cut and well-defined, but you can see they're kind of draining a little bit. Pustules, vesicles.
So they're just external?
These are mostly external, at least in the male. Now, female, most everything is going to be internal, and that's one reason why it's more difficult to diagnose females. because it's, you can't obviously see the ulcers. But that's one reason why this is primarily a male disease. Okay, diagnosing it, we can do a Gram stain. We know what Haemophilus looks like. So Haemophilus ducreyi looks just like the other Haemophilus. Haemophilus cissus. That's Peter. Was it Peter said Haemophili? Whatever. Okay. Gram-negative Cocobacillus. They're rods, but they're tiny, tiny fat rods. These Haemophilus ducreyi tend to grow in chains or form chains, or what we call a school of fish formation. And if you're a fisherman, you know what that looks like. I'll show you a picture here in just a minute. Okay, we can culture it, but we do need the chocolate, and this is probably more than just regular chocolate with supplements in it and vancomycin, and that's to suppress normal flora, the vancomycin, which is a powerful antibiotic, so that we can grow and have a better chance of isolating the Haemophilus ducreyi. Being a bacteria, it is treatable. And again, you don't have to know specifically what antibiotic, because they're going to use different antibiotics, but just understand that it is treatable. And it does not resolve itself without treatment. Some of these will resolve without treatment, but this one doesn't. Okay, here's the school of fish formation. So you've got the gram-negative rods, and they tend to form in chains, or they just this grouping arrangement, like little schools of fish that swim around together in the lakes or streams or whatever. Okay, let's go into gonorrhea. Gonorrhea, 400 to 500 cases per 100,000 population. So as we saw in the newspaper article, gonorrhea is very prevalent. And we know what the organism looks like. So we've worked with Neisseria meningitidis, we've worked with Neisseria lacnica, so gonorrhea has the same growth characteristics, except if we did CTA sugars, what would we see with Neisseria gonorrhea? Glucose only. Okay, usually occurs in the adolescent years, young adult ages, 15 to 29 is where it predominantly occurs. Symptoms. Okay, for female, symptoms, lower genital tract infection, including vaginal discharge, dysuria. What's dysuria?
Painful urination.
So sometimes it might start out, they might think, just based on symptoms, that they have urinary tract infection. The acute urethral syndrome is what we called it before, which is actually a sexually transmitted disease, but it has symptoms of urinary tract infection, urethral irritation, rectal infection may be present. In males, it's an acute urethritis with dysuria and urethral discharge. Rectal infection can be seen more common in homosexual males because of their sexual practices. So that's one reason why we're seeing more of these STDs, is because of the increase in the types and numbers of sexual practices that are going on. This one does have complications. Okay, so we'll try to mention complications on certain of these diseases when we know for sure that they occur. Okay, here's what Neisseria gonorrhea looks like. In fact, I think we used the same slide for Neisseria meningitidis. So these are gram-negative intracellular diplococci. We call them the gonids. Remember talking about the gonids? Gram-negative intracellular diplococci. So this is one reason why doing an initial Gram stain is helpful, at least presumptive identification. If we see that, that tells the doc we're dealing with Neisseria gonorrhea. Don't always see that, but it's possible. Okay, here's the type of discharge that you see. It's kind of a purulent discharge. And sometimes called gonococcal drip. In fact, Dr. Anderson and I, some years ago, were attending a convention. I think it was in Atlanta, as I remember, but it was someplace. We were inside a hotel, and the speaker was speaking about sexually transmitted diseases. And it was a woman, I think. She happened to be speaking on gonorrhea at the time. It was raining, just cats and dogs outside. And it started to drip somewhere in the room. And we were in the back. And we both looked at each other and started laughing because we were thinking, what a couple grip. You know, just like college students, you just start giggling and you can't stop.
What you guys are in for?
Okay, how do we diagnose this? Well, we can culture it, obviously, on chocolate and MTM, right? What does MTM do? What grows on, what is it selected for?
Niceria.
Pathogenic Niceria, except for which Niceria will grow on it?
Lactic
acid will grow on it, but primarily pathogenic. Okay, so chocolate, MTM, and then they have these two special types of media. Well, they actually have our MTM media. They're just special ways of transporting it called Gembeck and Transgrow. These are usually used not in hospitals that do routine identification, but maybe more in physician offices or special sexually transmitted disease clinics, STD clinics, where they see a lot of patients. So this is the Gembeck. The Gembeck is kind of a square plate. And you just kind of streak it in this manner. So you take a swab, you get some of that discharge, that fluid, on the swab, and you just kind of rub it around, make this like a W, and then you take your needle and just go back and forth and spread it out that way. And the Gembeck has a special CO2-generating tablet in the package. So you break that, and it releases CO2, because we know that these organisms require CO2. So that'll get the organisms growing. In the meantime, and the clinics might have the facilities to grow and culture this by themselves, or they might start this initially and have it picked up and taken to a carrier. But usually the clinics do their own simple type stuff. So this is what the Gembeck looks like. This is in a special bag, and there's the CO2 generating stuff. The Transgrow, this is the best picture I could get, which is not a really good picture, but Transgrow is in a bottle, kind of looks like a square rectangular blood culture bottle. But it also has a layer here of the MTM media. And so you can streak that, and then it will generate its own CO2. And so that's really, when they do these, that's all they're looking for, is gonorrhea. And so if something grows on there, it's most likely gonorrhea. You're not going to see Neisseria meningitidis in samples for sexually transmitted diseases. Okay, let me back up to this slide. In males, the Gram stain, as we saw, is very helpful because we can see those gram-negative intracellular diplococci. Or even if they're not intracellular, if we see gram-negative diplococci, that's pretty indicative of Neisseria gonorrhea, and particularly if they have types of symptoms that the dog would recognize. Okay, now this one does have complications. So in females, the complications are primarily salpingitis. What's that again?
Fallopian
tubes, infection, inflammation of fallopian tubes, and PID, the pelvic inflammatory disease. Okay, again, that's a lower infection, lower abdominal pain. It goes along with systemic symptoms, fever, chills, malaise, anorexia, so just really don't feel well. Patients, females, can get PID more than once. If they have it once, they have a 25% chance of sterility. If they get it three times, they have about a 75% chance of sterility. So this can lead to sterility. They also have about an 8 times increase in an ectopic pregnancy, which means the fertilized ovum implants in the fallopian tube instead of getting to the uterus, and that can cause some severe problems. So those are some of the complications that can occur in the male: epididymitis, prostatitis, so inflammation of those organs, and it can be disseminated. Now, dissemination also occurs in females. I should put that up here as well. So dissemination can occur in both sexes, which means, we'll see a slide here, but it can affect other body parts that are not just the genitalia or related to those areas. Probably the most severe is congenital. We've talked about ophthalmia neonatorum. What is ophthalmia neonatorum?
Eyes.
Yeah, the eyes. So the infant that passes through the birth canal of an infected mother can pick up the organism and cause these severe eye infections, which can lead to blindness. We'll talk about some other complications, but it is treatable. Penicillin is still the drug of choice for Neisseria. They have not yet proven to be resistant like many of the other organisms. So penicillin can be used, but some of the newer ones, the newer cephalosporins, can be used in people who are allergic to penicillin or whatever. Okay, so complications then, again, can occur in both sexes, go to heart, cause heart problems, eye problems, prostate in the male, urethra, again, in the joints, liver, but you can oftentimes get a chronic arthritis in the joints from gonorrhea.
Does it resolve naturally without treatment?
It can, but it can also lead to these complications. So, and it's so easily treatable that it's really best to seek treatment. But of course, people in other parts of the world that don't have access to treatment won't get treated. So here's ophthalmimunitorum, the implant. And the way they get around that, as we talked before, is putting erythromycin drops in the infant's eyes. They used to use silver nitrate, now they use erythromycin. This tends to cause, continued use of that tends to cause resistance of the organism to erythromycin. They might use something different now, but by putting eye drops in there, especially if they know or suspect the mother is infected, will help prevent that type of disease from happening. Okay, let's go on quickly to lymphogranuloma venereum. This one is caused by Chlamydia trachomatis. Okay, there are different serovars or different serotypes, so it's probably not the same one that causes trachoma, which is the number one cause of blindness worldwide. And we will also talk about the other type of sexually transmitted disease caused by chlamydia. So, but this one, these serotypes cause lymphogranuloma venereum. Okay, and again, mostly in other parts of the world. We don't see a whole lot of it in this part. Symptoms start out as initial skin lesion, oftentimes asymptomatic, which is, again, one reason why they don't seek treatment, but it can develop into larger lesions, discharge if it occurs in the urethra. And then inguinal lymphadenopathy follows, anywhere from 2 weeks to months after the initial lesion or infection. It's a firm, tender, red lesion that develops, that enlarges and becomes more painful, and it drains a thick, yellowish fluid. But oftentimes is associated with buboes. And we know buboes are swollen lymph glands, usually in the inguinal or the groin area. And then you can see the lesions on the genitalia. Okay, diagnosis. For females, cervical and urethral swabs. We can aspirate fluid from the swollen lymph nodes. That looks pretty painful to me, to stick a needle in there. Biopsy of the lymph nodes, or the lesions, if they're available. We can do serology, because again, this organism, we can only grow it, since it's chlamydia, we can only grow it in cell culture, so serology would be the best way to do it. It is treatable, tetracycline, and other antibiotics. One of the problems with lymphogranuloma venereum is the complication. Healing causes scarring and blocked lymph channels. And that results in massive enlargement of the genitalia in the males, which you can see because they're external, could result in rectal narrowing in the females. That's the type of thing you see, it's a blocked lymph channels. And the lymph, we know, is what drains the fluid from the surrounding tissues. It takes it back into the blood. If those lymph nodes are blocked, then we get swelling. You can see the swelling in the legs, the edema all here, but primarily, it looks incompatible with life, but he's definitely alive. Yeah.
So is that similar to what's going on with elephantiasis?
It's similar, but it's a completely different organism.
Okay.
Because elephantiasis is a parasite that gets in there and blocks. This is a bacteria, Chlamydia trachomatis, that blocks it. And in fact, we had several years ago a missionary, I think, that had been in one of the countries that had seen this, actually seen this. I guess they had a wheelbarrow, and they carried the thing in a wheelbarrow. All right, I think we need to quit here. So, I didn't get to lab stuff. I'll explain what we're doing up in lab. Everybody meet at 7:34. Initially, okay? Let me just explain what we're doing this week. Thank you.